How do you spell rescission? It means clawing back some government spending, and it's in the news today. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. Today we'll hear about the Trump administration's effort to not spend $15 billion in already approved debt-fueled budgets. I'm joined now by Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Washington. Kimberly, rescission is the noun for the verb to rescind.
Right. If you remember your civics class, Congress holds the power of the purse in government, but the executive branch, the president, has to spend the money according to the law. But there is a process that lets the president say, hey, this particular thing is not really a good use of money, and I'd like the authority not to spend it that way. Congress needs a simple majority to approve these kinds of changes, and they have 45 days to say yes or no. Other presidents have done this, but the last time this was used was in 2000 under Bill Clinton.
All right. But in this case, what funding does President Trump want to retract?
So the biggest chunk is going to be coming from the Children's Health Insurance Program, about $7 billion. The administration says this wouldn't hurt the program, as most of these funds are in accounts that for one reason or another can't be spent anyway. And this is the argument they're using for the rest of the money as well, that they're rolling back things like a rarely used loan program. Now, obviously, we need to see the proposal to know for sure.
All right, but context, $15 billion on the scale of the federal budget is big or little?
I mean, it's a lot of money, but not necessarily a big chunk of federal spending, and it's much less than the earlier numbers that we heard for this. Initially, the administration was floating up to a $60 billion rescission package, including cuts from the recent omnibus spending bill. What we're expecting today is much less and does not pull from that $1.3 trillion spending package that was passed earlier this year.
Our Kimberly Adams, thank you. Let's do the numbers. The FTSE in London is up just slightly. Dow and S&P futures and NASDAQ futures are down in the 0.3% range. Crude oil is back below $70 a barrel this morning, even though today's the day the Trump administration could pull out of the nuclear deal with that big oil producer, Iran. What's been the role of drug companies, drug wholesalers, and healthcare providers in the spread of the opioid epidemic? Facing scrutiny in front of a House committee in Washington today are execs from five companies, including McKesson and Cardinal Health. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, here's Dan Gorenstein.
Wholesalers are required to monitor and alert the DEA of suspicious orders. That didn't happen when 30 million doses of painkillers got shipped to Bell County, Kentucky, population 27,000, over 6 years. That's more than 6,000 doses for every man, woman, and child in the county. Kentucky Deputy Attorney General Michael Brown.
You cannot believe statistics like that. Your mind can't get around 30 million doses of drugs in a small rural Kentucky county.
Lawmakers are expected to pepper wholesalers with questions about pill dumping. University of Michigan's Rebecca Heffagy says companies have reached settlements on this because authorities have strong cases.
When it's these sort of outlier huge shipments that are being made, it becomes more difficult to justify not actually reporting it.
McKesson and Cardinal Health both declined comment for this story, but they are expected to acknowledge making mistakes in their testimony today. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Once a darling of Wall Street, the Canadian pharmaceutical company Valeant had a great fall after, among other things, it emerged it was radically hiking the cost of some of its drugs, including an AIDS drug. Now there's news of a name change. Valeant is not choosing a synonym like maybe Audacious Pharma. Valeant will become Bausch, B-A-U-S-C-H. Yes, like Bausch & Lomb, the contact lens company, which it bought a couple years ago. Starting Monday and for the following next 40 days, there will be public events across the country to consider jobs and poverty with a focus on people with jobs who still live in poverty. It's tied to Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign 50 years on. Marketplace's Renata Sago takes us to Memphis, where people are getting ready for an ambitious program.
The meeting room in the basement of the First Congressional Church of Memphis is packed for a training session on community building and peaceful protest. Clergy members rock back and forth, singing a civil rights anthem next to activists, residents, and workers like Ashley Cathy.
I'm still struggling, even though I work three jobs, so I'm poor.
The 28-year-old works the maximum number of hours the law allows for part-timers at Church's Chicken and also at the Crown Plaza Hotel. On the weekend, she works at a nightclub called Paradise.
At Church's, I only make $7.35. At the hotel, I make $10.50. And at Paradise, I make $2.23.
She relies on tips there. Since Kathy's mother died 2 years ago, she's been putting in more than 100 hours a week to help take care of her younger siblings. She says she has no health insurance, and she really can't save money either. For her, the phrase, hard work pays off, is an illusion.
I'm still working hard today, so why haven't it paid off?
Some 40.6 million people, or 12% of the U.S. population, live in poverty, according to data from the U.S. Census Bureau. And the U.S. Department of Labor finds that Black low-wage workers like Kathy are disproportionately poor. That's one reason why thousands of volunteers in more than 40 states are reviving Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign, urging lawmakers to change policies they say reinforce poverty and racism.
We've not made any advances in any of these areas, and in fact, in some of those areas, people are hurting more.
Beth Foster is treasurer for the campaign's Tennessee chapter. She says the campaign's goal is to bring awareness of many Americans who are a car wreck or health emergency away from financial ruin. Economist Margaret Sims with the Urban Institute says for low-wage workers, there's little opportunity for upward mobility.
The structure's just set up in a way that works against you.
So workers like Kathy can't save money to buy property, invest in stocks and bonds, or pass those assets on to the next generation to give them a head start. In Memphis, I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.